shining sea, everything possible other than the Greeks, and in that particular corner was under his particular control at this time. As one of the commentators put, this is no teacup emperor. This is an amazing, powerful man. And so that's what you begin to see here. He brings all of the people together for this amazing feast. He brings all of his armies together and all the nobles and all the governors and anybody who was anybody was supposed to be at this particular party for 180 days. So that he could, according to this, show his royal glory and the splendor and the pomp of his greatness for many days. And when those days were completed, the king gave for all the people present in Susa. And Susa is the citadel, the capital of this. He throws another feast for everybody. Everybody is invited to this one for 7 more days in the court and the garden of the king's palace. And then he goes on to describe it. Amazing linens, amazing pillars of marble, this porphyry on the pavement itself, marble, mother of pearl, and precious stones. Drinks are going to be served in golden vessels, vessels of different kinds, and royal wine was lavished according to the bounty of the king. He knew how to throw a party. Many times as a police officer for 25 years, we knew which of the teenagers were able to throw the parties, and we knew basically where they were, and we, as you all know, they're called keggers, and we knew exactly who threw the best keggers for these kids in the area. And hopefully we broke up enough of them also. But this is what he was doing on a much grander scale. He knew exactly how to throw these parties. And when they got there, they were sitting in total amazement. One of the things that I began to look at this was, they are literally sitting on couches made of silver and gold. I want you to think about that. Some of us hide our rings because they're pure gold, okay? Because that's all the gold I have, and you know, my wife has a couple of necklaces and maybe an earring or two that real gold in it. These are couches of silver and gold that people that are sitting on. I mean, it's amazing when you begin to think about the pavement itself has such precious stones in it that anybody else of nobility during the time would have kept them and hid them away as precious treasures. And yet here the mosaics are very much just on the pavement. Throughout the gardens and throughout the palace. As I began to think about that this week, or in the last couple of weeks, I guess, why so many verses? Why does the Scriptures give us so many verses to be able to show the opulence here? I mean, there's got to be a point to it, because I believe that every word of Scripture has been inspired for a purpose, and so we need to take a look at that. And one of the things that I began to see here was it's meant to impress us. It is meant for the Jews who this was written to and written to us today to impress us about this wealth. I mean, it's the same thing today, right? You build your barns. Build your big homes, build your pools, build our play courts, build our tennis court, our dining halls, whatever they may be, the bigger the better. I know somebody that just recently built a runway on their property so they could land their personal jet in one of our nearby communities here. That's amazing that you're going to do that. And they don't need to. They no longer work. The idea is basically to impress people. To impress people with your great worth when you can do that. It causes a little anger, doesn't it, when we see that? Now, we're drawn to it. It's like you're drawn to an accident. You can't help but go down the road and you see an accident with police lights on. You got to look. Okay, everybody's got to look. That rubbernecking, you know, I mean, everybody does it. And then you all need help. You know, I need some psychological decompressing because I saw something out there. You wanted to see it. You looked. But that's nature. That's human nature. We want to look upon that. It's the same thing when it comes to this opulence. And today, look at the TV shows on Discovery Channel. It's amazing. You know, the rich and the wealthy and the famous and all of what they have. You know, I've watched one recently on the RVs. You know, I mean, RV, it's a recreational vehicle, okay? And the thing's got a price tag of like $1.8 million. Seriously. And so, but it's the same idea that we have here. It causes a little anger in each of us when we see that type of thing. There's a sense that it causes somewhat of a revulsion when we see amazing opulence completely used for themselves. And don't get me wrong, I am not against having things. I'm not against us and God blessing us individually so that we may have things. But there becomes a sense when it steps so far over the line that the pure opulence tends to well up within us some type of revulsion, because it is just so much directed, look what I got. Y'all don't have it. Look what I have. We watch Hollywood. We watch all of the amazing weddings that go on at that particular time. Why did you spend that kind of money for all of it? There's a sense to which we are just simply turned off by what we see. Ahasuerus, King Xerxes, is the very picture of power and wealth at this time. He squanders that which he has for his own pleasure. That's what we find revolting. That's what turns us off. For a person that may hand it out to others to take the good of society and the good of culture into mind, to be able to do things with that, it doesn't turn us off. That's the ones we say amen to. They're the ones that we kind of hold up. But amazingly here, this would have been your tax dollars at work during that time. We're not going to go any further with that. But that's what they were faced, their tax dollars at work here. But in the midst of all of it, we get to see and we begin to see what the rest of the book is going to show us. You're going to see that the destruction of the king and of the empire, there's a little chink in here. There's a little crack in the dam, if you will, and it comes at verse 8. You get a picture of it right off the bat. And drinking was according to this edict. There is no compulsion. That was the edict. For the king had given orders to all the staff of his palace to do as each man desired. What that basically meant was there is no rules on how much you can drink. My waiters are standing by at your elbow right now. So whatever you want, you can have. There is no compulsion. But it's amazing when we begin to think about Ahasuerus' purpose of saying that. And why did the writer tell us that? Just to show that they're just going to be even more drunken brawl? No, as it's going to unfold to us here, you're going to see that King Ahasuerus, in all of his power and his wealth, had to micromanage down to the smallest point of minutia. Okay? Oh, they're going to get drunk. They're going to drink all they want because we're going to make it available. But I'm going to make it a rule that they can drink as much as they want. Why? This doesn't make much sense. But the king is so much in control, knowing what's about to occur, he wants to be ahead of the game, and he makes a law about it, that you'll drink whatever you want to drink. Okay. That's a law now. And so you see a picture here that in his kingdom, of which he has this picture, that no detail is too small for him to handle and for him to be involved in. He is the mighty Xerxes. He is the almighty. He's large. He's in charge. But I submit to you once again, when we look at the antithesis of this, when we begin to look at the satire of it, real power and respect doesn't come from the minute regulation of anything that you're involved in. True leaders, true people of power, don't need to find themselves managing everything to that degree. Government regulations, you think about that. Burns, I don't know how much longer you're all going to be able to sell your stuff, okay? Because the government wants to control everything, every little bit and piece of it. They want to show and flex their power and their muscle. But when we as individuals begin to do that, we find that we're really trying to compensate for a lack of confidence in our own power. The lack of confidence that I really have in my own power, I'll begin to micromanage things. And so that's what we begin to see here. Right off the bat, you get to see this little chuckle. Hey, I'm going to make it a law that you can drink all you want at my party. Oh, okay. Thank you, large and in charge, Xerxes. I appreciate that. But we see the kingdom beginning to deteriorate then in the next couple of verses. On the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded these seven dwarfs come in. Well, eunuchs, sorry. These seven is a referral to Disney's dwarfs. Nothing. Don't send me emails. I meant the seven dwarfs, okay? Not any disparaging remarks to, you know, short people. On the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded these seven eunuchs to come before him. Now, it's amazing when you begin to think of it. Seven more days of drinking. Okay? So, how drunk are these people at this particular point? This is the picture that we're going to see. And so, what he does is he draws these eunuchs in there, all seven of them, to bring his wife back in. Really? Can't you send a message through one of the unknowns? No, I'm sending seven of you guys. Seven of my eunuchs are going to go bring Vashti here. To bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown in order to show the people and the princess her beauty. For she was lovely to look at. These people's judgment is very, very altered at this particular point. 7 days of drinking with no compulsion. He probably had to stand one or two of them up to be able to get them to pay attention to what he was even saying. But what did he want to do here? And it's difficult for us to understand, but in the Hebrew writings, get a picture of this. Some of the Hebrew scholars, and I'm not sure that most of our today's scholars completely agree with the Hebrew scholars on this. Nevertheless, the point is the same. Some people believe that when the way this was worded, that he wanted his queen, his wife, to appear before all of these drunken men wearing nothing but her crown, the way that it's worded. And so whether or not that is actually what is meant by here, the premise is exactly what it is meant, the way that it is worded. To bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown in order to show the peoples and the princes her beauty, for she was lovely to look at. What he was doing was he was showing off his trophy wife. He's done everything else. I mean, from sea to shining sea, I still can't beat the Greeks at their game, but we're going to talk about that after we sober up a little bit. Okay, but in the meantime, if you see all my opulence around here, have you seen my wife? And so he sends for his wife to be brought in, to be put on display. No matter how the interpretation goes for this, it is degrading to his wife. It is once again a picture to the depths that ultimate power and ultimate self-indulgence will lead us to. Here is his most precious relationship, supposedly, in all of earth at this particular point. And what does he want to do to her but degrade her? His sole intent is to bring her in and to simply show her off to his drunken buddies. So you're starting to see that in the midst of this empire, this amazing empire, we're starting to hit these road bumps. The power of the empire hits amazing road bump here. If we look at verse 12, but Queen Vashti refused to come to the king's command delivered by the eunuchs. At this, the king became enraged and his anger burned within him. A mere woman said no to the king. Now, ladies, don't start throwing things at me. I'm being facetious here. I'm reading it in context the way that it said. A mere woman said no to the king. The law of the Persians could not be revoked, but apparently it could be refused by a woman. Once again, are you starting to see the satire written into this? You can't revoke one of your laws, but apparently your wife can refuse to obey it. Hey, king, you might be able to compel all of your buddies to drink to the point that they're drunk, but you will not compel me to come in there simply as a toy for you. I refuse to do it. And now all of a sudden, this empire seems powerless to be able to do anything about it. It has conquered peoples. It conquered the Jewish people, for goodness sakes. It has an amazing empire below it. And now all of a sudden, this woman, of all things, says no to the king, and the king and the empire is powerless to do anything about it. So what's he do? Huddle up, conference call. over this way and this way, guys. Just sit around here real quick. You guys are my advisors. Look what I got to say. What am I supposed to put your goblets down? Oh, by the way, another picture. I didn't even mention this. It's amazing when the scriptures say that none of these two goblets are the same. These are gold goblets. Not one is like the other. It was such a sign that during the Persia time to be able to have all of your glasses different was a sign of wealth. Hundreds upon thousands of these goblets were done. Not one of them the same. Sidelight, just to show the opulence even further. But he's calling, put your goblets down. We need to have some type of powwow here. Then the king said to the wise men, who knew the times? For this was the king's procedure. And he calls these seven guys to him. What are we supposed to do according to the law? What is to be done to Queen Vashti? Because she has not performed the command of King Ahasuerus delivered by the eunuchs. These people now become instantly terrified for their own homes. They're terrified. What's going to happen if we're infiltrated by these forward-speaking women? Maybe there's more than Queen Vashti out there. Maybe our homes are going to be taken over by these forward women that are going to say no to us. Then Mamukin said in the presence of the king and the officials, not only against the king has Queen Vashti done wrong, but also against all the officials, all the people, the provinces of your kingdom. For the queen's behavior will be made known to all women, causing them to look at their husbands with contempt, since they'll say, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti be brought before him, and she did not come. This very day, the noble women of Persia and Media have heard of the queen's behavior, will say the same to all the king's officials, and there will be contempt and wrath in plenty. What is going to happen to your kingdom, king, when the women start saying no to us? We're not going to have the authority in our own homes. The commoners are going to understand that they may have to put up with a defiant wife. What are we to do? Story goes on. In 19 and 20. Here's Vashti's results to her. Just summation of it. If it pleases the king, let a royal order go out. This is Mamukin talking. And let it be written among the laws of the Persians and the Medes so that it may not be repealed that Vashti had never again to come before King Ahasuerus. She got what she wanted at that particular point. And let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she. Oh, she may be fine to look at, but there's got to be somebody else better out there than that. You know what that's setting up if you know the story of Esther. You know where this is going. So when the decree made by the king is proclaimed throughout all of his kingdom, for it is vast, all the women will give honor to their husbands and the king. She called his bluff, and she got basically what she wanted. I don't have to go, but I'll never go again. And so really, was it worth it? Was her way of saying no and standing up at this particular point to this jerk of a husband of hers, to be able to say no to him and to get away with it, did it work to her benefit? Well, she didn't have to go in this particular time, but she lost her crown. She lost everything of who she was at that particular point. And the reason I say that is because you're going to see this unfold with Esther. Esther learns a lesson here. So keep that in mind. That is one of the reasons this is being set up here. Her place of honor is going to be given to a one better than she. But more importantly, for us to see in chapter 1 here, resistance is possible. Even in a culture that is hostile, resistance is possible. Assimilation isn't necessarily inevitable. So once again, we see the buffoonery of this empire. They tried to enact another law. Well, my first law was you can drink all you want. So let's make another one. Maybe we can make this one as stupid as that last one. This advice pleased the king in verse 21. Pleased the king and the princess, and the king did as Mamukin proposed it. He sent letters to all the royal provinces, to every province in its own script, and to every people in its own language, that every man be master in his own household and speak according to the language of his people. Now consider this. His last stupid law he was able to enforce because everybody's going to drink anyway, so they're going to. I'm just going to put it my stamp of approval on it ahead of time. Now he enacts a particular law with all the full weight of the king As a matter of fact, the picture here is he had amazing, I think Rich last week called it the Pony Express, okay, time to be able to get words, get information from one end of the empire to the other edge, the empire. The fastest horses possible. That's what the scripture's telling us here. Everything at his disposal to get this edict out. Nothing more important to this king than to get this edict out that women will remain under the thumb of their husbands. That was the edict that was going to be sent out, and it was given complete 100% enforcement by the king. But think about the enforcement. Think about it. The king hasn't been able to do any of this little stuff. He wasn't even able to control his own wife, and you'd think he'd probably want to keep that a little quiet. So in his effort to kind of say, hey, what are we going to do about this? Should we keep our mouth shut? Oh, no, let's proclaim it to everybody how Queen Vashti just completely defied me. And we're going to get the fastest way to get that information out. But then you say, how is he going to enforce that? I'm a commoner. I'm a carpenter out here on the outskirts of the empire. And my wife ain't listening to me. Do I banish her?
Well, never again will you come before me until dinner's ready. And then you can bring it in.
How are you going to enforce this type of stupidity? That's what we see here. This is what we begin to see once again. This little big man syndrome that Xerxes has. It's like the little tack that needs to be placed down on a fine piece of furniture and you go get your 4-pound sledgehammer to put that little tack in there. That's happened at our house, by the way. I won't say by who. Okay, but we've seen that. And so you get that hammer out and you whack that tack down. That's the picture here. That's the response that we have. The impotence of this leader. Kind of what we live in today, isn't it? Our workplaces, our judicial system, some of our judicial system. Thank God, again, that we live in a judicial system. I don't say it just simply because Jeff's here, but in a judicial system in this county, which we can be so thankful for. But just outside of our borders of this county, judicial systems which are nearly farces. Think of the political circus that is going on in America right now. Just think about that. We're about to turn control over to possibly one of two people which won't know which edge of the hammer to even hit things with. It's amazing when we begin to see this. Some Christians in other countries live in those countries that are controlled by dictators. They're controlled by warlords. They're controlled by these drug cartels, very, very dangerous places. And so what's the question when we begin to see this? Do we begin to assimilate in all of that? Do these people, do these Jewish people, in the midst of all that they see in this opulence and this power that is going on in King Xerxes' courts, do they assimilate to what he says? Or do they lose hope? Or do they stand for truth? Because there's a third option as we see this book unfold. And so, what lessons do we learn from this chapter this morning? Keep in mind the satire that is constantly going to be played out in this book. Don't take the power brokers too seriously. Do not take power brokers too seriously. Oh yeah, you may have to obey, and you may have to follow particular times, but don't take them too seriously. Don't take our culture too seriously. Don't find that the way materialism is pushed down our throats constantly in this society, in this culture, don't find it that we have to define success based upon all of that. That I'm not successful if I don't have this. I'm not successful if I haven't raised to this level in my company. I'm not successful if I don't have this degree. I'm not successful if I haven't done this in life. We allow culture and we allow society to define in us what we should be when we know we are children of the King, that we have a future with Him forever. Do not allow culture to define our identity in that. Do not take these power brokers too seriously. Even though we hear the revelings going on from the citadel, as the Jewish people would have, because it's on a high hill, this castle, this palace of his, is on an extremely high hill on the edge of town. And so anything goes on up, any partying going on, just wells all over the entire city. So they can hear it. They can see the soldiers in the streets constantly as a reminder of who they are. We don't find ourselves allowing all of that to define who we actually are. And so the bottom line is, do not take too seriously the power brokers of our home, of our lives. Don't let it tell us to go ahead and just simply build our dreams. Sometimes we do have to turn the Disney movies off just to simply follow your heart, to simply follow your dreams deep down, what you personally want. That's what the world tells us. And if the mantra of the world is constantly just simply follow what makes you happy, it is good reasons for us as Christians to step back and to reevaluate all of that. Is it true that I need to follow my dreams? Now, I'm not saying that you don't follow dreams, but if that becomes the impetus, if that's simply, that's a dream of mine and I'm going to go for it, not good advice. You take advice based upon the rest of scriptures. You take advice upon confidants and spiritual people that are in your lives to be able to say, is God really the one that is placing that dream in my life? Esther chapter 1 teaches us that this world displayed by our culture has no substance and no foundation. And there's times that we need to laugh at that. Now, I don't mean we become idiots. I don't mean that we just simply sit back there and laugh at things. What's he laughing at? This is bad. This is a bad situation going on. But there are times that we sit back and we look at what my relatives in England send me, the pictures of our potential candidates for the next presidency, and with a meme, and it says, seriously, America, is that the best you can offer? And you have to step back and laugh about it. Because I know people in Jefferson County personally that are better candidates than that. And so we need to step back and we look at culture and we look at that and we need to say, there's something funny about that. It is the insanity and the ridiculousness of it. And so that's one of the reasons that I believe that we can keep from assimilating into this when we see the ridiculousness of society many times. Secondly, we're also going to see here and understand that God is intentionally having us to wait on his mighty hand. We have to wait and understand that the events of history are moving in an exact direction that God himself intends for it. I don't care who on January 1st or January 21st, when do we do that with the president? 21st, something like that, when he's sworn in, I don't care who that is that we swear in January. It doesn't matter. God is in control and taking our country in a direction that he intends to take it. And that's why we have to begin to define these things. Because exactly what you're seeing here, seriously, you look at all these pieces of the puzzle that are... The king gets everybody drunk, his advisors, he gets them all drunk, and then he asks them advice on some very important matters and makes some stupid decisions upon stupid decisions, gets rid of his queen for some reason, and the entire country knows that there's a new edict out there that can't be enforced. That's all just stupid coincidence? Or is God literally in the process of bringing things about? Could not bring Esther into the picture without getting Queen Vashti out of there, right? Couldn't have done it. And so we see it by the pieces being pieced together. But did they see it? The question is, did the Jewish people of the time see that Queen Vashti getting moved out? Probably many of them didn't even care. Big deal. The king got rid of his queen? I'm sure there's plenty lined up for that job somewhere along the way. Many of the Jews probably thought they're having a party up there. Well, I wasn't invited. Big deal. How's that going to affect me down here in the carpenter shop today? Many of the events that we see unfold here absolutely didn't even make the radar for these particular people. But in our perspective, looking back on history, we know that God very clearly was making things to come about exactly in his will that he wanted. And thirdly, God's kingdom is not the kingdom of Ahasuerus. keep in mind, the writer of Esther, as I said several weeks ago, uses peripeteia, uses like this exact opposite in the writing is what you kind of expect it's going to occur. Uses coincidence in the writings to make his point. And I think beginning right here, we begin to compare the kingdom of God with the kingdom of Ahasuerus. First and foremost, think about the king. Here's a sovereign king in the book of Esther. Nobody's greater than him in all of the world at this particular point. He is king. You will listen to him. And yet, what happens to his queen right off the bat? What happens to his edicts that he is going to hand out? Bring her in here, eunuchs. She said, no, you're not coming. Okay? Instantly, we see a sovereign king with absolutely no power. Compare that to the King of Kings. Compare that to our king sits in heaven. A sovereign king that sits on the throne that no man, no person, no thing will thwart his will. Nothing is going to come across that's going to be contrary to what he has. He's a sovereign king. But it's interesting. And I began to think about that earlier this morning too. We serve a sovereign king. One in the likes, I guess, from one perspective of King Xerxes, who is sovereign over all things. But our king, who does all things for his own pleasure, always does it with a loving, benevolent, merciful tendency toward us. It's still for his good pleasure. But this king, Xerxes, it was all for his good pleasure, and it didn't matter who he stepped on. It didn't matter if he degraded his wife at this particular point. It didn't matter if he killed innocent people. It doesn't. It's all for his good pleasure. And so we begin to see it, and that's what Esther wants, the writer of Esther wants us to see, that we begin to compare King Xerxes with the true king, our true king. And then you begin to compare it with the banquet that goes on here. Think about the banquet that you have here as opposed to the banquet that the King of Kings is going to have some particular day with his bride, the church, as the scriptures say. He's going to present us. You see the picture? I want my wife, Xerxes says, I want my wife presented for the lustful intents of all of my drunken buddies here. We're going to be presented as a church someday before the Father by our husband, by our groom, Jesus Christ. And we're going to be clothed in righteousness which cost Jesus Christ everything upon a cross one day. That's what we're going to be clothed in. And yes, we're going to be put on display as perfect, as without blemish, as holy before the Father. What a contrast that we see here. And so my question then becomes today, who is the king that has your allegiance? Who is the king that your loyalty is given to? Is it given to this world's kings? Is it given to the materialism of this world? Or do we truly give our allegiance to the very King of Kings, knowing that someday we are going to be presented at a banquet, and what an amazing banquet that's going to be, that I'm going to be presented as a bride before the Father, but I'm not going to be simply put on display for some lustful, sinful intentions, but I'm going to be placed there as a result of the love that the Father bestowed upon me before time began, which was accomplished by his Son Jesus Christ upon the cross. That's the banquet that we need to be looking forward to. So once again, I'm back to that question. What king receives our allegiance today? We're going to close in prayer.